It's time for Security Now. Steve Gibson is here. An update on the AMD flaws, some more details. Turns out this is probably the real deal. We'll also talk about the big Pwn2Own conference. Goes on, just went on last week. All the machines that are hacked, all the machines that couldn't be hacked, and a sterling play-by-play, all coming up next on Security Now.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for Security Now is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com. This is Security Now with Steve Gibson, episode 655, recorded Tuesday, March 20th, 2018. Pwn2Own 2018. Security Now is brought to you by Eno, your intelligent assistant from Capital One. Shop online without using your real credit card number for your favorite merchant sites. For more information, visit CapitalOne.com/Eno/virtual numbers. And by ZipRecruiter. Hiring? ZipRecruiter has revolutionized how you do it. Their technology identifies people with the right experience and then invites them to apply to your job. Try it free today at ZipRecruiter.com/SecurityNow. And by Rocket Mortgage from Quicken Loans. Home plays a big role in your life. That's why Quicken Loans created Rocket Mortgage. It lets you apply simply and understand the entire mortgage process fully so you can be confident you're getting the right mortgage for you. Get started at RocketMortgage.com/SecurityNow. It's time for Security Now, the show where we get together with the smartest guy I know when it comes to this stuff and figure out what's going on in the world around us. Mr. Stephen Gibson of the GRC, GibsonResearchCorporation.com. Hi, Steve.
Leo, it's great to be with you once again.
Live long.
I'm looking at our Security Now episode 655 and thinking, ooh, in 11 weeks, we're going to be at 666.
Devilish. Which,
you know,
the devilish episode.
Is.
We've never done a 666, have we?
We never, no. And I've also put this at two-thirds of our way through the history of this podcast, because, of course, that's going to end at 999, because I only have three digits. So,
you're really serious about that. I was hoping you were just joking.
I got everybody worried about that right now. And they're like, no. Someone suggested use negative numbers. It's like, no, that doesn't
work. It's about six more years, but you know how fast this first 13 went. It could go like that.
Yes. That. And, you know, and you still have your hair. So so we talked last week about the fact that the day after last Tuesday's podcast, which would have been, what, the 14th, Wednesday the 14th, and the 15th and the 16th were the Pwn2Own conference, which has been since 2007, an annual event up at Canada, hosted by Trend Micro's Zero Day Initiative, and also in this case, sponsored by Microsoft and VMware. We have the results of that competition, for better or for worse, and sort of a little bit of both. So that's going to be we're going to wrap that up. And we're also going to require from you, Leo, a dramatic reading of the two-day event. Because with a little bit of massaging from what they provided in a couple of their blog postings, I pulled it together and pumped it up a little bit so that it's a little bit more like maybe an Olympic judging contest.
You're not going to make me read this whole thing, though, are you?
Well, if you don't, I will, because I think people okay. will find it interesting. But I think it'll be pretty good. So
I don't know if I can do the whole thing in a funny voice, but I'll.
You don't
I'll
have
do
to
my
do
best.
If you need to fall out of character, that's fine. I just as I was reading it, I was thinking, okay, you know, this would be good the way this thing was put together. So.
Cool.
But we're also going to talk about the aftermath of last week's surprise announcement by CTS Labs that I know you've been talking about on other shows.
With some suspicion, I might add.
Yeah, well, about motives and intent and so forth. And in reaction to that, their CTO has formally produced a statement that I want to share, because it's there's something to empathize with also. And of course, we just now, 90 minutes ago, have a reaction, the first official reaction beyond the first little sentence from AMD themselves. So we want to talk about that. Also, Intel now has announced plans for their own future. And we have some recent microcode update news that was actually, I should have looked last week to see what was happening with that KB4090007 page, because it's much expanded. So that's good news. We also have several Microsoft recent announcements and actions. Also, another lesson, and they just keep on coming, about the importance of testing. In this case, three popular VPNs, all of which were found wanting when tested. Also, I do want to touch on, just because it's a some interesting bit of technology, and I know you were just talking about it over on MacBreak Weekly, this last evening's first death caused by a self-driving automobile. Also, I have a bit of an update on the progress with Squirrel. And as I was waiting for the podcast to start, I was thinking how anxious I am to get back to it, because we're right down to the last few little things to be resolved. It's getting very exciting. Also, we'll have a bit of closing the loop feedback with our listeners. And then we're going to talk about the mixed results from this year's Pwn to Own, which significantly had no Chinese participants. And that's a little bit of a tease for why it was a bit of a lackluster result.
All right. Well, if you don't mind, I'd like to introduce you to somebody kind of cool named Dino. It's time for a word from our sponsor, and a new sponsor for this show, but one that I kind of got to know when I was down at South by Southwest. Capital One, you know, you've seen those ads, you know, what's in your wallet and all of that. Capital One, because this is Security Now, they wanted to talk about something a little more serious than rewards points and all the other good things that come with a Capital One card, and that is Eno. Eno is their virtual assistant, and Eno has added something I think you will absolutely love: virtual numbers. You know, we all use credit cards online.
Oh, yes.
Hallelujah. Oh, and you'll love how Eno works with the virtual numbers, because it's a Chrome or Firefox plugin, soon coming to Edge and Safari. So when you go to a merchant and you want to use your credit card, actually, I'm not signed in here, so I won't. And I probably shouldn't show you my credit card number. But what's cool about it is this will generate a one-time credit card number per merchant credit card number. So the idea is, if I use this now on Amazon, I can make this my regular credit card on Amazon. It stays good. In fact, it gives you an expiration date 5 years from now, from today. It gives you a unique security code and a unique number. It's tied to your Capital One credit card, but it isn't your Capital One credit card. And the merchant doesn't get anything, any information about you. They get just a token. So online merchants never see your actual credit card number. I really like this for a couple of reasons. First of all, if that number gets compromised, you just throw it out. It's like an application-specific password, kind of, right? You revoke it. And, you know, it's no longer good. And if your real card gets lost or stolen, and I really like this feature, you get a new credit card, of course, from Capital One with a new number, but that virtual number remains good. And this is huge because, well, it's happened to me many, many times where, and it unfortunately happens to me on the show, I often, as you know, I've shown my credit card number. What can I say? Either I'm demonstrating something, and you see it, at a, you know, in my wallet, or sometimes we'll switch to a screen as I'm entering my credit card number, and that's one of those oh no moments, because not only do I have to call and get a new credit card, that's not such a big deal, but all of the accounts associated to that credit card, I have to call each and every one of them and say I've got a new number. They call it the dreaded reset moment. Actually, I talked to Tom Poole, who's a VP, Senior Vice President in charge of digital e-commerce, about Capital One. We were talking about that, and he explained and we have a little audio clip of him doing this, how Eno works to prevent that dreaded reset moment.
When we looked at this and realized that the most pressing problems our customers were facing was this giant reset moment, this whether the card expires or it's lost or stolen or it's compromised online, this moment when suddenly out of the blue you were being asked to spend a couple hours updating your numbers on every single site. It's terrible, and people live in fear of it, so much so that they actually steer their shopping toward a handful of sites that they trust and avoid trialing new experiences and new products precisely because they're afraid that it's a game of Russian roulette. If they put their number at one more site, that might be the site that triggers the event that is the real pain in the neck for everybody.
Yeah. So now you can use your credit card without fear. If you accidentally lose control of the credit card number, you don't have to. I can vividly remember going through my statements last time I gave away my credit card number by showing it on screen and having to go through several months of statements and say, oh, yeah, there's a recurring payment. Oh, yeah, there's a. And then going to each every one of those and changing the credit card number. I don't have to ever do it again. I'm using Eno from now on. If you have a Capital One credit card, just download and install the extension from the Chrome Web Store. You'll sign into your account, as you saw when I showed the screen there. And now Eno will generate a fresh number for you anytime you want one. It's easy to manage your virtual cards, too, because you get a list of all your virtual cards, which merchant they're associated with. You can revoke them at any time. It's easier. You'll feel better shopping online, and you don't have to worry about that dreaded reset moment. Eno is the virtual assistant that comes with all Capital One credit cards. Get your Capital One credit card, and Eno's got your back. Virtual numbers. And I know we've talked about these before, Steve, and what a boon they are. For more information, visit CapitalOne.com/Eno/virtual numbers. CapitalOne.com/Eno/virtual numbers. And they took us down to South by Southwest a couple of weeks ago. We had a great time doing a security panel down there. And I'm really happy to be able to tell you about the Capital One virtual numbers. And you still get rewards. You still get all the benefits of your credit card. But all of that is hidden away, which is great.
We have talked about the idea of virtual credit card numbers, Leo, yeah. And this is wonderful.
It's also the easiest way to do it because sometimes you have to go to a website, generate a number, then go back to the original website. This is having the browser plug-in really is great.
Well, and do we know which browsers it supports?
Yeah, right now it's Chrome and Firefox.
Oh, okay.
Coming soon to Safari and Edge and Internet Explorer.
Nice.
Yeah, they want to be everywhere, of course.
Nice. Well, that's
great?
A big win. Also, if you associate the number with a particular merchant,
you know,
and somebody
exactly.
tries to use the number
you know
anywhere else,
yep.
it immediately triggers
right.
a shutdown.
Well, it won't work. It's associated with a merchant, so right. Capital One, yeah, it says no, you can't use this number with that.
Very,
with anybody
very
but that
nice.
Merchant. So it's really it's a clever solution. Yeah.
Very cool. So our picture of the week. I got a kick out of. It's the result of last week's Pwn to Own. We talked about how there would be the award given the Master of Pwn. And this is the guy, Richard Zhu, or I guess maybe it's who? I don't know.
Zhu.
Zhu. Richard Zhu, who won the contest. And this is him wearing his Master of Pwn sweatshirt. You know, giving himself some props, which he has earned and which we will be talking about later in the show when we talk about the result of the Pwn to Own 2018.
He got more than a nice jacket, though, I must say.
Yes, he did.
Yes.
Yes, he did. So, as you commented last week, one of the best named exploits to come along, the Ryzen Fall, which was, of course, one of the four classes. The biggest one was the hardware problem in the Chimera vulnerability. These were announced as we were literally going to press as I was putting the podcast together Monday Monday evening as I was assembling everything. The topic was different, and Tuesday morning it was, oh crap, this is important. We need to change the title of the podcast, and so I quickly rearranged things. So in the week that has ensued, the controversy, of course, which we discussed last podcast, was that the CTS Labs, a relatively new, unknown security firm, about a year old, did not provide AMD with the what has now become customary. Well, customary is 90 days. As we know, Google's Project Zero gave Intel 200 days because of the they understood the nature of the severity and you know knew that Intel would take this seriously. Anyway, this was not the case with CTS Labs. There's been a bunch of fur flying over the last week. Some people saying that there was no proof of this. The good news is that one independent researcher, Dan Guido, who we referred to also last week, who's the CEO of Trail of Bits, did independently verify the report and tweeted to that effect on Twitter. He said, regardless of the hype around the release, the bugs are real, accurately described in their technical report, which is not public as far as I can tell, and their exploits work. So at this point, we're beyond wondering whether there's something here, and we're now at the point of like, okay, so what's the impact of this to end users? What's the, you know, how does the world feel about the way CTS Labs acted, and where what is AMD's position? So first of all, the consensus is much like Spectre and Meltdown, these are difficult to exploit. They do require admin, and this is still a little unclear because we don't have details. But what we're being told is that administrative access is required for these to be exploited, which is not true of Spectre and Meltdown, which caused a much more concern. That is, any unprivileged process was able to leverage the, if it was clever enough, the Spectre and Meltdown vulnerabilities in order to get cross-process information leakage, which was the big concern. What we're being told is that this requires administrative access. So you have to first have some privilege elevation in order to get that access and then exploit it. On the other hand, later this podcast, we'll be talking about elevation of privilege attacks, all of which the attackers at last week's Pwn to Own were able to achieve. So we shouldn't take too much. I mean, AMD is trying to play up the fact that, oh, you have to be an admin. Well, that's not looking like that's that difficult for an unprivileged process to obtain for itself. So AMD, as I mentioned before, is on record now acknowledging the four problems. That is basically saying we're not happy with CTS Labs for not giving us any time, but yes, we acknowledge ourselves that these are problems. Okay, so but there was a lot of pushback about, you know, like against the way CTS Labs handled this. So I want to share the letter that the CTO just published on the amdflaws.com site addressing this, because, I mean, this is an issue for the industry moving forward, and I think he raises some interesting and worth discussing points. He starts by saying, by way of a disclaimer, I am a technical guy, he writes. I love building things and researching things. I do not like the whole world of PR. He says, it is too messy for me. I've written this letter in my own language without PR proofing. Please forgive me if there are any grammatical errors or not written according to correct writing standards. He says, on the history of their publication of these exploits, he said, we have started researching AS media chips about a year ago, and that's about when this group pulled themselves together and declared themselves an entity. After researching for some time, we have found manufacturer backdoors inside the chip, which give you full control over the chips. Now, And what's interesting, too, is that a lot of us have these chips on our motherboards. So the focus of their disclosure was AMD, because AMD had formally used a descendant of these in their own chipset. But this may still have some farther-reaching consequences, which have yet to have been articulated. Anyway, he says full back hardware manufacturer backdoors giving you full control over the chips. And that's the ASM1042, ASM1142, and ASM1143. So, you know, and if someone's interested, although this hasn't been leveraged as far as we know yet into exploits, you can probably determine if those are the AS media chips on your motherboard. He said, we wanted to go public with the findings, but then saw that AMD have outsourced their chipset to AS Media. So we decided to check the state of AMD. We bought a Ryzen computer and whimsically, he writes, ran our exploit POC, our proof of concept, and it just worked out of the box. Full read, write, execute on the AMD chipset, as is, no modifications. To be honest, he says, we were a bit shocked by it, how they have not removed the back doors when integrating AS Media IP, intellectual property, into their chipset, he writes, is beyond me. So then we said, okay, what on earth is going on in AMD, and started researching AMD. He says, it took time to set up the working environment to start communication with the AMD secure processor. But after reaching a full working setup and understanding of the architecture, we started finding vulnerabilities, one and another and another, and not complex, scary logical bugs, but basic mistakes, like screwing up the digital signatures mechanism. At that point, about once a week, we found a new vulnerability, not in one specific section, but across different sections and regions of the chips. It's just filled with so many vulnerabilities that you just have to point, research, and you'll find something. He says, parens, obviously a personal opinion. After that, he writes, we decided we have to go public with this. I honestly think it's hard to believe we're the only group in the world who has these vulnerabilities, considering who are the actors in the world today and us being a small group of six researchers. So he then starts the next section titled Responsible Disclosure. He writes, I know this is an extremely heated topic for debate, where everyone has a strong opinion. Unfortunately, I also have a strong opinion on this topic. I think, he writes, that the current structure of responsible disclosure has a very serious problem. If a researcher finds a vulnerability, this model suggests that the researcher and the vendor work together to build mitigations with some time limit, 30, 45, 90 days, whatever, at the end of which the researcher will go out with the vulnerabilities. The time limit is meant to hasten the vendor to fix the issues. The main problem in my eyes with this model, he writes, is that during these 30, 45, 90 days, it's up to the vendor if it wants to alert the customers that there's a problem. And as far as I've seen, it is extremely rare that the vendor will come out ahead of time notifying the customers. Quote, we have problems that put you at risk. We're working on it, unquote, he writes. Almost always it's post factum. Quote, we had problems. Here's the patch. No need to worry, unquote. The second problem is if the vendor doesn't fix it in time, then what? The researcher goes public with the technical details and exploits, putting customers at risk? How we have accepted this mode of operation, he writes, is beyond me. That researchers advertise at the end of the time limit the technical details of the vulnerabilities because the vendors didn't respond. Why should the customers pay for the vendor's lack of actions? He says, I understand this is the model today and people follow suit, but I think we can do better. I think that a better way would be to notify the public on day zero that there are vulnerabilities and what is the impact. To notify the public and the vendor together and not to disclose the actual technical details ever unless it's already fixed. To put the full public pressure on the vendor from the get-go, but to never put customers at risk. This model has a huge problem. How can you convince the public you are telling the truth without the technical details? And we have been paying that price of disbelief in the past 24 hours. Okay, oh boo-hoo, but still. He says, the solution we came up with is a third-party validation, like the one we did with Dan of Trail of Bits. In retrospect, we would have done this with 5 third-party validators to remove any doubts, a lesson he writes for next time. I know there are many questions and a whole lot of confusion. We're trying our best to answer reporters, update our site with Q&A, and clarify what's going on. So far, the media focus was on CTS, and I think I understand this. But very soon, we will have to deal with the fact that a huge company with products spread throughout millions of computers in the world is riddled with so many problems that it's unclear how to even address this. If you have any technical questions, please contact me at, and he gives his email address. I'll try to answer as many as I can. So, you know, that's his position. One of the attacks that they have come under is this issue of the AMD stock price, you know, and, you know, this sort of being the equivalent almost of insider trading, where if they were convinced that the public would react negatively to this news, then they could go short on AMD stock and then make a hyperbolic announcement, which actually they, you know, I mean, this follow-on statement is a little stronger and worrisome than their original AMD flaws website and technical disclosure that was a little more sober than what they came out with. You know, and I mean, I would argue, I guess my position is there, I can sort of see what he's doing. Certainly AMD is under massive pressure, although it's difficult to believe that they would have been any less motivated to fix this in a timely fashion had this disclosure been done privately. That is, he's right about the size of the problem, how widespread it is, how bad it is. He had proof of concept code. He had one person he could point AMD to. AMD could certainly validate it just as quickly as Dan at Trail of Bits could. And especially on the heels of Spectre and Meltdown, they would understand the severity of this. So my take is this was not them behaving correctly. It's not as if AMD wouldn't have immediately taken action. I think it's clear that they would have for something like this. So it looks like they were wanting to be glory hounds in an industry where common practice has been to give the company some opportunity to fix this, because in fact their behavior has demonstrably put users at risk. I think that's clear. Given the nature of the problems, the fact that if it's the case that the chips are riddled with security vulnerabilities of the kind they say, and having so clearly pointed us to where they are, there is now a window which is wide open, which would not have been if firmware updates were available. And almost all, there's the Chimera, remember, had two aspects, a firmware problem and a hardware problem. They claim the hardware problem cannot be fixed, that it's in hardware. AMD has in their own disclosure some talk of mitigation, although they say that they're working with the vendor. So, you know, they're also not saying that this isn't the case, that there is this kind of problem. So, but all of the rest is firmware fixable, meaning that patches can be created. And in fact, in AMD's statement from about 2 hours ago, they are saying firmware patches are underway and will happen as fast as possible. Given that this is a third-party chipset, you know that AMD is putting pressure on AS Media, and AS Media is going to be moving as quickly as they can to preserve their relationship with AMD. So, you know, looking at this whole thing, I have to say that if we say that the goal is to truly protect end users, to protect the people who have the systems, then as long as there are measures in place to patch firmware, and we now know that both Linux is able to and Microsoft are able to, as part of the boot process to apply a dynamic firmware update, as long as that's in place, that should have a chance to happen before the discoverer of the flaw is able to or does make a public disclosure. I think that's really where we have to come down. So
should we be worried about other ASM media chips in Intel machines, like a USB controller or anything like that? I mean,
I think so. I think that one of the takeaways is that they've already found what they call manufacturer backdoors inside three other chips, yeah. ASM 1042, 1142, and 1143. And, you know, I mean, I know I'm not sure what the vintage of those chips are, but I'm sure I've seen when I'm looking at device drivers.
Oh, yeah. They're all over the place. Yeah.
Yeah. And so this could be much farther reaching. So they already had backdoors in these other multiple AS Media chips. And it was when they discovered that AMD
right.
had subcontracted this chipset family to AS Media that these guys said, whoa. And they got a Ryzen machine and they ran their proof of concept and it took over the computer. And so that's when they said, whoopsie, this is bigger than, you know, one audio chipset vendor. This is AMD and everybody who's using those chipsets. So I don't think we've heard the end of this AS Media problem. And what we may be seeing is driver updates from AS Media that fixes the firmware in their own chips.
It's just those four ASM chips that we know of so far.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Right. And we will, of course, on this podcast, be covering that as we get more news and information.
Yeah, and AMD indicated that they thought they could have a firmware fix pretty quickly, which was interesting.
Yes,
yeah.
Yes, which is to say that, you know, they verified this themselves. I'm sure they stomped on the Taiwanese AS Media hard and said, okay, look, fix this right, you know, I fix this tonight. So, and these things should not take that long. I would argue also, this is much more of a, like a software feeling fix than the Intel microcode stuff. I mean, it's firmware, this is a higher level software-y feeling fix than
right.
Intel's.
Right.
So it makes sense that it would be like, whoops, you guys, you know, aren't checking a digital signature properly, that's a higher level, easier to fix thing than microcode in the Intel architecture. And speaking of which, we got an editorial was just posted from the Intel CEO. And I looks like his name is Brian Krasanich. Thank you.
Yeah.
Brian Krasanich. He's talking about, okay, like where Intel goes from here. Advancing security at the silicon level was his editorial. And basically what he wrote comes down to, in the second half of this year, the next silicon coming from Intel, which is the Intel Xeon scalable processors, which are codenamed Cascade Lake, as well as the eighth generation Intel Core processors, both expected in the second half of this year, will be incorporating next generation hardware fixes for the Spectre and Meltdown problems. So as we know right now, they're scurrying around with microcode patches essentially to the existing, fifth, sixth, and seventh generation architectures. They'll then be doing essentially everything for the last 5 years. Naturally, anything next they do will incorporate from manufacturing improvements. And because they have some time now, there's no articulation yet, and this has caused some annoyance in the industry. He's talking about security protective walls. In his editorial, he says, while variant one, will continue to be addressed via software mitigations, we're making changes to our hardware design to further address the other two, meaning the much more concerning Spectre problems. He said, we have redesigned parts of the processor to introduce new levels of protection through partitioning that will protect against both variants 2 and 3, which are the Spectre variants. Think of this, he writes, as additional protective walls between applications and user privilege levels to create an obstacle for bad actors. So no more details than that at this point. And the processor watchers in the industry who are really wanting to know what Intel is doing are expressing their annoyance at not having any more detail yet. But I'm sure that'll be forthcoming. And he's at the CEO level, so he's just reading what engineering told him to read. But what this does say is that, as would be expected, whereas what they're having to do is essentially to emergency patch the existing architectures of the existing chips, next generation, and all chips moving forward will get probably better mitigation, not only built in, but have the opportunity to be better. And as I mentioned at the top of the show also, I forgot to have us take a look at where we stood with 4090007. That's that KB page. If you Google KB4090007, that's the Intel microcode updates, which Microsoft is publishing in their own updates. And whereas the first time we looked, there were only two, and that's what then motivated me to update my Inspector app so that it clearly displayed the CPU ID, because you know whether there's something for you based upon those IDs. Now there's a ton. It's actually eight different CPU IDs spanning Skylake, KB Lake, and Coffee Lake. And one of the other things that Brian said in his editorial was that they now have firmware updates available and published for all processors released in the last 5 years. So Skylake, KB Lake, Coffee Lake, as well as Haswell, and one other that I can't remember. But so, you know, everything in the last 5 years. So they've jumped on this. And at this point, it's still a go get it from Microsoft. But Intel has made those available. Microsoft has incorporated those into an evolving update that you can find at KB by Googling KB4090007. And then you can use Inspector to get your CPU ID and see whether it is now among that growing list, in which case installing that update will give you will modify Windows so that every time it boots, your processor is freshly patched with the firmware changes that allow the worst of the Spectre vulnerabilities to be mitigated in hand with changes to Windows. And speaking of changes to Windows, this month's Patch Tuesday had a bunch, I think it was 15 different vulnerabilities that were fixed. But among the things that were fixed was that Microsoft released updates for finally, and I was hoping for this, I'm going to have to change the language once I confirm. In fact, I'm just turning around. I have a Windows 10 x86 machine.
I was wondering what that was behind you.
Yes.
I've never seen a laptop behind you. Yeah.
You can see it back there. It's been updating for about 5 hours. You know, these updates are not – when you do a major, you know, move, it can take a while. And I haven't had this machine on for a while. So it looks like it's done. And I wanted to have – my hope was that it wouldn't take that long and I'd be able to verify. But I assume the news is correct, which is – that Windows 10 x86 now got updates in March. That is, there already has them for microcode running the Win 10 Fall Creators Update, as well as Intel's 6th gen Skylake processors. And now we know. So that would have been built into the updates, which is news. That means that the automatically delivered updates included Skylake instead of having to go get it yourself. Not all the other ones yet, but so it sounds like Microsoft is staging the release of this. Right now, if you really want to go get it, you can, for example, to get also KB Lake and Coffee Lake coverage, which is what's in the KB4090007. But given the fact that in just this month, a couple weeks ago, they did incorporate microcode updates for Skylake, which were the first ones to appear at that patch it yourself page. This suggests that as soon as Microsoft is, you know, absolutely sure that the firmware isn't going to cause any other problems, that this will get rolled into future, probably April's Patch Tuesday. So that means that ultimately everybody's going to get themselves fixed. But now they Windows 10 Fall Creators updates had been alone. They moved it to x86. But now we also, as a consequence of Patch Tuesday, we have the x86 also versions of 7 and 8.1. as well as Server 2008 and 2012. So Microsoft's doing the right thing. They are getting everything covered. And that means I'm going to be changing the language in Inspector here in a second after the podcast is done. And I've verified it myself to confirm that the x86 variants of these Windows OSs have been fixed, because in Inspector at the moment it just says, you know, I hope Microsoft does this. The good news is they are doing it. So that's great. And in which case, Inspector will be able to show you some better news. And Leo, speaking of better news, I've got some coffee that needs my attention.
And the news is always good when the coffee is fresh. Our show today brought to you by ZipRecruiter. Are you hiring? If you're the person involved in hiring in your company, you got to know about ZipRecruiter. It's the easiest, best way
for the best people to find you. Notice I said the best people to find you. So here's the deal. If you're hiring, you know that I think we can assume that somebody's out there that's just right for the job. And by the way, let's really emphasize how important your job is. You are building the company. The company is, if the company were a Lego model, those bricks would be the people. And a bad brick, the whole thing falls over. A great brick, your company can go to the moon, right? You got to get the right people. That's all a company is the best people. So your job, super important. Filling that position, I don't care what the position is, super important. Yeah, it might be the mailroom. That might be your next CEO. Who knows? That can happen. It happens all the time. So let's assume the right person's out there. You want to know, how do I reach that person? Now, what you don't know is which job board that person's on, or where they've submitted resumes, or what part of the country they live in. You don't need to with ZipRecruiter, because with ZipRecruiter, you post once, and immediately your posting goes out to 100-plus job sites. And ZipRecruiter has built a platform that finds the right candidates for you. That's right, finds the right candidates for you. They learn what you're looking for. ZipRecruiter identifies people with the right experience, and then invites them to apply to your job. These invitations have really revolutionized how you're going to find your next hire. 80% of employers who post a job on ZipRecruiter, 80% get a quality candidate through the site in under a day. Imagine if tomorrow, this time tomorrow, you already have the perfect candidate. That's what happens. And ZipRecruiter doesn't stop there. All of those applications, as we've talked about before, flow into the ZipRecruiter interface. They spotlight the strongest applications so you won't miss that person. They say, look here, this one. The right candidates are out there. We know that. ZipRecruiter is how you find them. You've got the most important job in the company, and now you've got help to help you do it right. Businesses of all sizes trust ZipRecruiter for their hiring needs. And right now, you can try ZipRecruiter free. Right now, free. At ZipRecruiter.com/security now. ZipRecruiter.com. But make sure you go to /security now so Steve and I get credit, because ZipRecruiter supports our show and that's how they do it. ZipRecruiter.com/security now. ZipRecruiter. Simply put, the smartest way to hire. And they're gonna make you look good, which I like. Steve, you have employees, don't you? I guess you do. You have two.
I do. I'm their lifelong employer. I think Sue's nice? Been with me for about 30 years.
When you find somebody good, don't let them go.
Ah, right.
And then, as you did, let everybody else go. How many employees did you have at the peak?
23.
Wow.
Yeah. And I was just, you can see what happened. I was pulling my hair out and it worked.
Now life is easy. Life is simple.
Well, it was the internet. I mean, I used to have two people full time
to go to Ingram, right?
Yeah. Just receivables. Yeah. Yes, just trying to get paid.
Yeah. Yeah.
And and a shipping department boxing stuff up and shipping them off. And now it's thank you, internet.
Yeah. Thank you. That's
internet. Like it's a win.
Yep.
Okay. So Microsoft has followed Intel in beefing up their bounties. Remember when we talked about this in February, so last month, Intel beefed up their own bug bounty program. And I don't quite understand why both of them, Intel and Microsoft, have a year-end deadline or expiration. But both Intel and Microsoft's bug bounty programs are only valid through December 31st, which I don't get, because it's not like bugs are going to stop.
Bugs expire
happening.
In December. Didn't you hear? No more.
Yeah, we wish.
We fixed them all.
So Intel has announced last month that they will pay out up to $250,000. Yes, $250,000 for reports of new similarly serious to Spectre and Meltdown side channel bugs. In other words, they want to know about these. If the severity ratings are 9 or 10, on the CVSS, the Common Vulnerability Scoring System, that is like top level, like top level severity, then you get $250,000 if you bring that news to Intel. If the severity is between 7.0 and 8.9, meaning just shy of 9, then you can get as much as $100,000. And below 7.0, you're down at $20,000. But still nothing to sneeze at. I mean, if it's some sort of a side channel problem. Well, so Intel announced that last month. Now Microsoft has virtually duplicated that program. Same sort of story applies. And I'm not sure what happens if you co-release the news to both of them. Do you get two paydays? I mean, I hope. So if anyone else is able to find anything wrong like Spectre or Meltdown, Microsoft says, we're going to pay you for that information. And similarly, it could be worth $250,000. Their announcement said today, Microsoft is announcing the launch of a limited time, same expiration, bounty program for speculative execution side channel vulnerabilities. This new class of vulnerabilities was disclosed in January 2018 and represented a major, writes Microsoft, advancement in the research in this field. In recognition of that threat, environment change, we're launching a bounty program to encourage research into the new class of vulnerability, which is cool, and the mitigations Microsoft has put in place to help mitigate this class of issues. So they're saying $250,000 jackpot is sitting here until the end of the year for anyone who can find anything else like this, or something that we missed in these vulnerabilities. So they have a four-tier. They said new categories of speculative execution attacks get you $250,000. Azure speculative execution mitigation bypass is worth $200,000. Windows speculative execution mitigation bypass also up to $200,000. And then instance of a known speculative execution vulnerability in Windows 10 or Microsoft Edge. And they say this vulnerability must enable the disclosure of sensitive information across a trust boundary. In other words, some way of using a known vulnerability that they missed, you can get $25,000. So this is all good. This is, you know, I mean, we've talked about this. Google, they're like at $1,600 or something. I mean, we've talked in the past about these bug bounties being so offering such little money that it wasn't clearly going to incent a lot of research. But $250,000, that's going to get you maybe thinking about other clever ways of leveraging our current processor technology. So that's what we need. We need, you know, we've seen, for example, with cryptojacking, where the ability to turn virtual cyber currency into money has created a huge amount of pressure to install crypto mining on, you know, unwittingly into people's browsers or servers. In other words, the fact that there's money at the end of the trail makes a difference. And so now we've got money at the end of the speculative execution trail, both from Microsoft and Intel. Maybe if you can get both, $500,000 for finding some new problem. And that's what it takes. It takes, you know, somebody wanting to find a problem to do so. And these companies have the money, so I think this is good. And I just don't know why it expires on New Year's Eve.
Well, maybe they don't want to be liable forever or something.
Yeah, I think that's probably it. Otherwise it's an open door, and they could be held to, you know, like held to it maybe forever. So Yeah, I think you're probably right. The attorneys probably got involved and said, you need to not let this thing be open forever. Yeah. So, okay, speaking of my laptop that took 5 hours to update this morning, I did want to inform our listeners that Windows, well, Microsoft, is changing the way Windows does its twice annual major updates. By Microsoft's estimate, the Creators Update, which was released almost a year ago, took on the average of about 82 minutes, during which time those roller coaster dots – is there any formal name for those things, Leo?
I like that. I nominate that for the name.
It always reminds me of a roller coaster where you kind of go over the top. Yeah, it's too bad they didn't use the infinity symbol though instead for the roller coaster, because that would be a little more representative of how long you're waiting. But anyway, so the roller coaster dots while you are offline was 82 minutes. Now in the fall creators update that some of us have just suffered through, they improved that so that the roller coaster dots were spinning, by their computation or their estimate, about 51 minutes. So we're coming into, and we referred to this in the last couple of weeks, it hasn't been officially named, but it's, you know, provisionally being called the spring creators update. And I can't remember what the context was for me talking about it last week or the week before, but there was something that they were going to be doing with this thing called the Spring Creators Update. I don't remember now what it was, but they're now saying that they're planning for this, what I would call the system unusable time, to be nothing more than about half an hour. So it's not gone, but they're trying to squeeze down to 30 minutes. And it's not that they've produced some miracle. What they've done is they have been progressively moving more of the work of performing one of these major updates, which, you know, it's essentially, it's a hidden reinstall of Windows. I mean, it is a whole new Windows that is coming in and then moving everything over from the old Windows into the new Windows and saying, okay, here we go. So what they've been doing is they've been moving more and more of that into the so-called online phase, where you can still use your computer. And they're saying that it's in the background with low priority, so it won't interfere. It won't make things sluggish while it's doing it. It's not like running cryptocurrency mining in your machine. But as a consequence, the total time required has actually inflated significantly, because they can't commandeer. They just don't want to commandeer your machine in this offline phase for as long as it would take.
They do something sort of like this right now. When you install Microsoft Office, it continues for a while in the background, but it might let you run Word partially.
Well, and remember, even booting, you know, famously, they were under – it took so long to boot first.
Can't do anything, but look, you're seeing the desktop.
Look, here's your desktop. Yeah. And, you know, exactly. It's not quite here yet. Things are still popping in, you know, populating. It's like, wait a minute.
What? It's ironic because the initial installs are actually much faster now because they use images and they blast them on.
Right.
It's the updates. Right. And if you think about it, an update is a non-trivial thing to do.
Oh, I don't even want to. I'm glad that's somebody else's problem because that's not a problem anybody wants to have.
I wonder, though, if you could just – do a diff, you know, just take the fully – well, you can't because every system's different, I guess.
Right.
That's the problem. If you could say, oh, just take – if you had a known system in the diff and then you just apply the vectors, the changes, even if it was nonsensical, it'd be just a little bit here, a little bit there. You could do it. But the problem is that doesn't work. Yeah, because you don't know the starting point.
Right.
Oh, man, I don't know how they do that. Must be somebody some genius's full-time job.
Oh, well, and when you look – at how many files there are. I mean, the whole Windows update thing.
It's crazy.
The idea that you can go in and remove one that you don't like.
I always think of it as the analogy I use on the radio show is you know, you've seen the magician who whips the tablecloth out, you know, and all the silverware and the plates are the same. Well, this is doing that and then putting a new tablecloth in. Yeah, right?
That's good.
You're whipping
that's
it out good. And then you're putting a new one in without disturbing anything. Good luck.
And in the process, you change the forks to chopsticks. So
Just because you can.
Yeah.
It's spring. Let's put in a yellow tablecloth today.
That's right. So we know well the lesson that you know nothing about security until it's been tested. I've used the example for years about Ballmer prancing around the stage before the release of Windows XP, declaring before its release that this was the most secure operating system Microsoft had ever produced. And, you know, I was here then. Yeah. And it's like, no, that's not something you can declare. Yeah. You can want it to be true, right. History is the judge of these things. So that is to say, only when something has been tested can you affirmatively say, I mean, and even then you can't say we know it's true, but you can say smart people tried to break it and couldn't. So that's a lot better than if that never happened, if no one tried to break it and everyone's just saying, oh, yeah, Ballmer's entertaining, so let's all use his operating system. So we got three – we had an independent organization, VPNMentor.com, that contracted with three external ethical hackers, one who wished to remain completely anonymous, one – well, he might as well be anonymous because his handle is File Descriptor. I don't know who that is, so he's anonymous. Palos Yibelo is the third guy who was the manager of this VPN testing team. The File Descriptor guy is a reputable ethical hacker working for Cure 53, who is a company we've referred to in the past. We've covered some of their work. And that was the company hired by Tunnel Bear to identify and fix issues with their VPN applications. And Cure 53 is a leading security research firm. Palos has found previously found vulnerabilities in popular VPNs and published them in the past. And his work has been covered in ZDNet, Slashdot, and other places. So these guys are real. Well, they took a look at three VPNs, Hotspot Shield, Pure VPN, and ZenMate VPN, and found significant readily exploitable IP leaks, that is IP address leaks, in all three. So
the user's IP address?
Yes. Yes.
That's not good.
Readily obtainable. Now we know that you don't use a VPN necessarily for complete anonymity.
That's not right. What a VPN is supposed to be. Yeah.
Right. That's what Tor promises more than a VPN. It is the case, though. You know, a VPN gives you encryption, and you get some anonymity because your traffic is going to emerge from an endpoint at your VPN host server out onto the internet, and hopefully. You know, and so the point is that at that point, the packets are being rewritten with your source IP is rewritten with that server endpoint source IP, so that when they go out to a server, the IP address that the website that you're visiting sees is the VPN server IP. The packet then goes back. The VPN server that's been keeping track of this rewrites the destination from itself back to you, and then the packet goes through the tunnel and so forth. So that's what we would – so it's sort of wrong to expect really strong anonymity from a VPN, but it shouldn't have – neither should it have really bad, readily exploitable problems. And all three did. Of the three organizations, only Hotspot Shield responded promptly and the way we would want them to. They had three problems, but they just immediately they stepped up, worked with the security researchers, recognized, acknowledged, and immediately fixed the problems. At this point, today, that has not happened with PureVPN and ZenMate VPN, both of whom have outstanding problems they've been informed about and haven't resolved. So, as we know, mistakes happen. Anybody can make them. I think it's significant that Hotspot Shield, you know, said, okay, we're on this. It would be nice if Hotspot Shield had themselves contracted for a security audit, the way, for example, Tunnel Bear did, get themselves audited and be able to say, hey, you know, we had people check us out and we passed. But the mistakes are interesting. So there were three problems in Hotspot Shield, all now fixed. One of the things that Hotspot Shield, a feature, is a Chrome extension to make it just sort of like, oh, look, it works, you know, easy drop in. Well, you know, that's not the way I'm going to run a VPN. I'm going to run a VPN by installing a client like OpenVPN and then using it to establish a tunnel, and then everything on my system goes through the tunnel.
I'm surprised these companies don't use OpenVPN, actually.
I know.
Well, that's weird, isn't it? Do you think they use a custom built VPN?
They might well use an OpenVPN protocol, but in this case, it was a Chrome extension that had a problem. There's a proxy autoconfig script, and it turns out that the proxy autoconfig script was looking for a query parameter in the URL of it that was ACT equals AF proxy server ping. And if that parameter was in the URL, it routed all traffic to the proxy host name provided by that parameter, which means any site could give you a URL like that you click on, and your traffic is hijacked, and all of your VPN traffic runs through this hijacking site. So, whoops, not what you want from a VPN. Also, they noted that the DNS lookup was using the system's DNS, which is that's an often made mistake. I've referred to this for years. Not all VPNs capture all of your internet traffic. That is, some of them just capture your TCP connections or your web surfing connections, saying, oh, yeah, you know, real easy VPN, whatever. But the DNS lookups don't go through the tunnel. Well, that was also the case. And the problem with that is that DNS leaks your IP. I of course, have that the DNS spoofability page where GRC pretends to be a DNS server for the user, and I end up being able to check the action of the DNS server. But it's possible to leak all the way back to your IP. There's a site, www.dnsleaktest.com, which operates very similar to mine. In fact, I was wondering if they were using mine, like proxying my page, because it looks they copied it, essentially, a sort of a subset of its behavior. But it demonstrates that it is very easy to determine who anybody's DNS servers are. I mention this to our listeners because this is a test you can easily perform. If you're a VPN user, fire up your VPN and then go to www.dnsleaktest.com and see whether it shows the same DNS servers, that is probably your ISP's DNS servers, or whether it's showing you the DNS servers belonging to your VPN provider, which is what you would want. You would want that you, for the DNS queries generated by your system to be tunneled through the VPN also, and not to just ignore it and make a standard system level DNS query, which can easily and readily leak your IP. And then the last thing they found was, again, in this proxy auto config, a very broad whitelist. And just because I thought some of our listeners might get a kick out of it, I have it in the show notes here. But I mean, it's amazing what is on the whitelist that bypasses the proxy. So much so that, for example, localhost at localhost.anything, if localhost appears in the domain name, it bypasses the VPN. So like, you know, localhost.evilsite.com, and you're not VPN'd. So it's like, whoops, again, all these have been fixed. It's worrisome that there were these problems, but this is a perfect lesson of, you know, you really just can't assume something is secure until somebody has looked at it. I mean, somebody who knows what they're doing has tried to find problems with it. And this is why, you know, talking to, you know, going back to these bounties, why I'm really happy to see Microsoft and Intel creating some significant cash windfall bounties for hackers, you know, to motivate hackers to try to find more problems. When we look, we find problems. And it's not until you have really, really tried hard and found nothing that you can begin to say, okay, this seems good. So anyway, people using these other two VPNs, I would look for updates, hopefully coming from them, of their fixes. And Hotspot Shield has immediately stepped up and fixed the problems that they were having. So hats off to those guys. And I did want to just touch on, although this is not a Security Now topic, just on this last night's news of a pedestrian death, just because it's a novel event. This is the first pedestrian death involving a self-driving car. This was – it occurred at in Tempe, Arizona, 10 p.m. last evening. There was a driver, a so-called, you know, backup driver in the auto. It was an SUV owned by Uber as part of their self-driving, you know, autonomous vehicle project. There was, remember, what was it, in 2016, Tesla had a problem. Their autopilot software was it was considered contributed to the death of a Tesla driver. His name was Joshua Brown, although he had ignored repeated warnings to put his hands on the wheel, and didn't. So, you know, he certainly had some responsibility there. In this case, it's not looking like, I mean, this just happened. So, you know, camera footage is being checked. The Uber's self-driving software, I'm sure, is, you know, black boxes and green boxes and red boxes. All the boxes are being probed. But the video footage that's been seen, the driver's report, nobody was impaired. The driver wasn't, you know, the backup driver was not impaired. Neither was the pedestrian. But a 49-year-old woman stepped out with her bicycle in the middle of the block, directly in front of the car. And the feeling was from the police reports that anybody, like a human driver driving along, it was a 35 mile an hour zone. The car was going 40 miles an hour. So, you know, about as much over as we all typically drive. It'll be interesting to see who decides where fault is. But I really liked what Andy had to say at the end of MacBreak Weekly too, Leo. I agree with him. That, you know, downstream, I wouldn't be surprised. It's going to take, you know, a couple generations, maybe a generation, 20 or 30 years. But I wouldn't be surprised if ultimately we get this stuff nailed. And it doesn't look like it was, you know, a technology fault.
I don't think you can blame the car at all. I mean, if
no.
I don't know what happened. As we're just going by the police report, and the police were the ones who said, the Tempe police said this couldn't have been avoided even with a human driver. But if you're first of all, I'm surprised it wasn't going the speed limit. That they should be dinged for that.
Yeah,
autonomous vehicles should travel exactly the speed limit, and maybe even a little less. But even going 35 miles an hour, if somebody jumps out in front of you, there's
reaction
physics.
Time.
You know, autonomy does not overrule physics.
Yep,
it's not even reaction time. The reaction time of an autonomous vehicle should be instant. It's physics. You can't stop. So I don't think you can blame. But of course, this will go against the account of autonomous vehicles, which is in a way a shame because I don't think it should.
Well, if it introduced another note of caution, that might not be a bad thing.
Sure.
Just, you know, it's like, let's slow ourselves down a little bit.
What would you do in the software except go down, go slow down?
That's a very good point.
Yeah.
What
would you do to fix it? You can't fix that.
Yep.
Can't fix humans. That's the problem. You can fix a machine. You can't fix a human. And you know what? It's going to happen. Sometime a kid's going to – I was telling Lisa this when we were talking about the story yesterday. Some kid's going to chase a ball out from behind a car and get clobbered by an autonomous vehicle. Now, it happens all the time by human-driven vehicles, but when it's a robot, that's going to be a problem.
Well, it's very much like how upset we get when an airliner crashes.
Right.
But we're not as upset by the distributed deaths occurring on the highways all over the country every day. I mean, you know, the famous line is that, you know, statistically, it's far safer to travel by air.
Yeah.
You know, nobody really likes
that. Humans are not rational. That's the real problem. We're not. And this is why I'm kind of stepping up to defend this robot vehicle.
I think you're right.
Because it'll be a shame if we don't get autonomy because of an irrational fear of autonomy.
Right. Right. And we won't talk about Terminator and Skynet. Because,
well, it's built into human psyche. We're afraid of these things.
That's another problem. Yeah. Okay. So I just wanted to give our listeners an update on where I'm spending still full time, and that is on Squirrel. Something I've been meaning to talk about since I mentioned it maybe a month ago. I called it the sensitive data monitor. I did a number of things. There are a number of things I now, looking back, I wish I had done differently. Not many, but like the internal architectural stuff turned out to, you know, not evolve as well as I wanted. But one of the things that I love is that every single string of text is in a separate file with a numerical number, meaning that it's super simple to change the wording of anything and, of course, to make it language specific. That I nailed that. Also, because it needs to be language, I wanted to give it the opportunity of being multilingual. Different languages require different amounts of space. So I always built in a scaling to the UI. Well, that turned out to be a win because of this DPI awareness that we need now, because our screens have gotten such high resolution that if the app didn't scale itself to the resolution of the monitor, it would be too small on high resolution monitors. And in fact, the Inspector app doesn't have this technology. And I've had complaints from people saying, I can't read it because, you know, they've got 4K monitors and the thing's the size of a postage stamp on their monitor. It's like, well, I'm sorry, get a magnifying glass. But anyway, so I got that right. The other thing I got right from day one, and I'm only saying this because I want other people writing secure code to hear this, mostly what I'm about to say next. But the other thing I got right was creating containment for everything that was sensitive. That is, there is one single location where everything that is sensitive ever resides. And I created it up front, so it was so everything I ever did was in that container. And that has turned out to be the biggest win, because it is easy to lock it in memory and to wipe it. And so that ended up being another, you know, really, I'm very pleased with that design decision. But something I did about a month ago, I wish I had done at the beginning. And so anybody who is going to write Squirrel components. We've got, you know, clients and server side stuff in the works. There's a Java side. There's a JavaScript. We got browser plugin. Android and iOS clients are on the way. So lots happening. About a month ago, and I mentioned this on the podcast, but I never followed up. I created a window, which I call the sensitive data monitor, and it is a window that dynamically shows the content of that sensitive data area and labels it and formats it so I can see it. And as a consequence of that, I had always intended to do this at the end of the project. Now it's ended up being so useful, I wish I had always had it. And that is that while you're – and this is only for, of course, for R&D mode and the developer edition where there's like all – it logs all of the guts of its crypto in order to help other developers confirm, you know, their internal operation, and it logs all kinds of stuff. It also shows you the contents of the sensitive data area. And as a consequence of that, not only did of my seeing it, but also letting the people who are testing the client have that, we found some edge cases where if you did this and then you did that and then you did this, then, oh, look, you know, a key that should have been proactively zeroed didn't get zeroed in that particular case. And as a result, I then have been subsequently far more aggressive in proactively wiping things. But then I caused myself some problems because I was over wiping. I was like, I broke some things by removing information that was necessary, which is why I wish I had done it from day one. Because then as I was moving through the development of this, I would have always had my eye on that, making sure that when I was done with some data, it was immediately eliminated. And again, I'm being over cautious. You know, nobody else, I mean, evidence demonstrates that people are leaving stuff in RAM all the time. So I'm wanting not to make that kind of mistake. But I just wanted to say to anyone else developing security-aware software, doing this, just having it there on screen while you're working with it is incredibly useful. And I'm almost done. I fixed a problem with Squirrel running in Sandboxy, which now it works just perfectly. There's some people didn't want to use the screen darkening. Squirrel has a UAC style screen darkening to demonstrate that you're using Squirrel to help to keep web browsers from being able to spoof Squirrel. And when we turned that off, because some people didn't want it, because it also breaks cut, copy, and paste, which is good because you don't want that for your password. But some people are, you know, they're wanting that. And so I allowed screen darkening to be disabled, but that created a keyboard focus problem, which I'll be fixing probably tomorrow. And then it's like I hesitate to say, because something that's this big and involved it never ends instantly. But I will then turn my attention to bringing up the web forums, which I'm gonna have online before the formal announce, because there's no way I can handle the consequence of all of our listeners grabbing it and starting to play with it. We need some place for people to go to, you know, self-help and answer questions and so forth. But it's very close to being time for me to come up to Petaluma, Leo, and sit down with you and maybe Ooh. Father Robert and go through this.
Just
and,
remember, I'm going out of the country April 19th through May 5th. So okay. Either before then or after then. Well, Robert okay. could do it. You don't have to have me here.
Oh, but you're a perfect foil. You're wonderful. I was like, okay, wait
you.
A minute now.
I'll
what
give you
what
a
does
foil.
That do? What does that button
what
do?
What the hell
again?
Is that for?
Hey, this just in, Expedia is announcing that the 880,000 payment cards have been exfiltrated by bad guys from their site.
Darn.
Yeah.
Well, what was that sponsor you were just telling us about, Leo?
Everybody's got to use One. Capital One. Between January 1st of 2016 and December 22nd, 2017, the breach for its partner platform, and then between January and June for its consumer platform, phone numbers, names, email, billing addresses. Orbitz was not affected, but Expedia was. So,
boy.
Anyway, just, you know.
Yep, it happens.
It happens again and again and again.
It happens. The good news is, if the world chooses to adopt Squirrel, we will never again have a theft of passwords.
Yes.
That's just gone.
Yay.
Because Squirrel gives websites no secrets to keep, which is nice. I got an interesting note from an anonymous sender. He used our web form for sending feedback, and he the subject was Spinrite story in 652, so what, 3 weeks ago, could have been social engineering. And his submission was dated March 7th, so a couple of weeks ago. He said, "Hi, Steve. I just caught SN652, listened to the Spinrite story." And so then he quotes a dialogue, or he makes one up. "Customer," he says, "customer, question mark, I lost my copy of Spinrite. I'm incapable of record keeping. I have no backups. I'm an unorganized person. By the way, the email I bought Spinrite with no longer works. Wink. Here's my new email address. Can I have a new copy, please?" And so GRC, he quotes GRC support saying, "No problem. We don't need to verify anything. We trust you. Here's a link to the download.
Isn't that nice?
Feel free to change your contact information. We'll just email you the secret PIN in plain text."
You shouldn't announce this on the air, Steve.
The customer responds, "Really? Yoink. If anyone asks, I was never here, and no, I am not wanted in 5 states for fraud." So then this guy says, "How is this different from anyone calling your cell carrier or your bank and claiming to be you?" He says, "This could have been social engineering. It is often said the customer is always right. But what if they aren't a customer?" Anyway, and then he says, "Looking forward to the end of Squirrel," which, as I just said, is approaching rapidly. He says, "And the beginning of Spinrite 6.1, which is also approaching rapidly." So I just wanted to say, we have a database dating back – well, actually, it's in FoxPro.
Almost DBase 2.
It was in DBase 2, and we updated to FoxPro. Running in a DOS box.
Wow.
And it's got Spinrite 1 customers in it. So I'm sure that Sue did look up this person's name. And, I mean, she does some due diligence. But at the same time, let's remember who we are. I mean, you know, the company's policies are an extension of mine. And we often share stories of somebody who let their friend run their copy of Spinrite. Last week, we said, you know, some guy fixed his dentist's RAID array and asked his dentist to buy a copy, and he believes they did as a way of thanks and sort of payment for, you know, the services that the software rendered.
That's the right thing to
do. You know, that's the way to be. I remember that back when there was competition, there were other hard disk utilities. Every single license said, "Can only be run on a single hard drive." And that just never seemed reasonable
to me.
You're
just not greedy enough, Steve.
It's just not practical. Well, you know, when I do something like Inspector, everyone says, "Oh, just charge a dollar, a dollar."
Yeah.
Well, yes, I would have made $547,000 or something. But on the other hand, people would have actually used it. So I think my policy is right. You know, Greg and Sue are gainfully employed. I get to have, you know, Cabernet, and I've had time. Thank you, everybody, to develop Squirrel and offer it to the world. Spinrite 6.1 will follow, and we'll go from there. So
this show,
And the show.
We'll send you some. We have a new wine sponsor, and we have a wine from them that I because I know you love cabs. I think you're going to really like. We're going to send a couple of bottles down, I think.
Cool.
That was Lisa's cool. idea. So that'll make up for that lost revenue.
Well, I don't feel it's lost.
No, I agree.
I mean, our customers, there's so many of our listeners have said they bought a copy of SpinRite to support the podcast and to support my efforts. Yeah. So, hopefully they're getting some value in return. It's not, you know, it's not a charity. It's like, here's some software. And the other thing I'm not doing, you notice, I mean, people complain that it hasn't been updated in a long time. Well, that's true. On the other hand, I'm not dinging people for upgrade fees every year, trying to milk their loyalty to SpinRite. So
that's a lot of the reason things get upgraded, not for real value, just because then they could charge you.
Yes. Yeah. Exactly.
Yeah, it's an annuity. No, that's what we love about you, Steve.
Well, anyway, I got a kick out of him saying that guy could have been making it up, and it's like, yes, he could have, and you know, fine. I'm not going to lose any sleep over it. We're doing fine, and I appreciate all the listeners who are honest. Closing the loop, two things. Akari Mattson said, any comments on this? And then quoted, EV certificates under DigiCert's Root CA without human intervention. And he or she provided a link to trustcubes.com/EV-SSL and ask the question, shouldn't EV certs be more scrutinized? And that's interesting because it's a great question. The answer is no, if the scrutiny is placed where it should be. For example, I have loved the fact, and I've mentioned this on the air, that I've been able and can issue my own EV certs with DigiCert. I've done it in the middle of the night when I've needed something, and I love that fact. Where the scrutiny needs to be applied is on that me and my account are GRC. That's the identity binding that needs to be absolutely verified. And what's cool is, independent of my certificate recycling and renewal, I will get contacted by someone from DigiCert saying, hey, we need to re-verify you for EV status. So, which is, I think, is brilliant. So what they've done is they've decoupled the timing of the identity binding to the account from the certificate issuance, allowing the account holder to issue EV certificates whenever they need to, and then while at the same time not degrading the integrity of the process because they are asynchronously making sure you're still you. So I love that question. I just wanted to note that, you know, there is a way that you can get the best of both worlds, and that's the service that DigiCert, in my experience alone, has been offering me, and I really appreciate it. And then I love this one other tweet from Itinerant. Itinerant? Yeah. Wait, is that the way you pronounce it?
Yeah. Itinerant.
Itinerant. Yeah. For some reason, that just seemed wrong to me. Itinerant engineer. Anyway, I love this. He tweeted both to me and to Swift on Security the observation, quote, perfect forward secrecy, unquote, is the, quote, I guess you just had to be there of encryption. And of course, that's exactly what it is.
And somebody just bought a copy.
And somebody just bought a copy of SpinRite. Thank you. And our final break, Leo, and then we'll talk about Pwn to Own 2018.
Indeed, we will, Mr. G. Our show today brought to you by Rocket Mortgage. You know, I think the financial services industry thinks you guys have a lot of money. Security Now listeners are a rich crew. We got banking, we got home loans, we got credit cards. Rocket Mortgage actually is for anybody who can't write a check for a house. If you can't pay cash, well, then you're going to get a home loan, right? And why not get it from the best, the best home loan company in the world. Quicken Loans, number one in customer satisfaction, 8 years in a row. They're now the number one in terms of loans. I just saw a number, like two, what was the number? 2 million loans, something like that. Largest lender in the country. And I think some of that goes to Rocket Mortgage. They're completely online mortgage approval solution. That this is really great. If you're a geek like me, you don't really want to put on a necktie and go down to the bank and apply for a loan. I mean, what a waste of time, you know? And you fill out an application, then you're not done then. No, you got to go home and find pay stubs and bank statements, go up in the attic or down in the cellar. It's ridiculous. With Quicken Loans new Rocket Mortgage, you could do the whole thing online. You don't no necktie. You don't have to get off the couch. You could do this on your phone at an open house. That's how easy it is. It's a complete client-focused technological revolution in the home loan industry. Rocket Mortgage. You get the confidence you need when it comes to buying a home, or I should say refinancing as well, if you have an existing home loan. It's simple. You'll know completely what's going on. You'll understand all the details and be confident you're getting the right mortgage for you. And it's really convenient because you don't have to go to the basement to get the financial records. All their trusted partners mean you can share your financial information with Rocket Mortgage just by saying, okay, touch a button. Whether you're looking to buy your first home or your 10th, Rocket Mortgage can do it for you, and they can do it for you not in months or weeks or days, but in minutes. Minutes. Based on your income, your assets, your credit, Rocket Mortgage will analyze all the home loan options. You know, computers are pretty fast these days. And find the ones that are right for you. You choose the term, the down payment, the rate. You're approved. Boom. Rocket Mortgage from Quicken Loans. Apply simply, understand fully, and mortgage confidently. To get started, go to rocketmortgage.com/security now. That's rocketmortgage.com/security now. They're an equal housing lender. Licensed in all 50 states. It's NMLSconsumeraccess.org, number 3030. You actually, if you go right now to rocketmortgage.com/security now, press that button that says refi or the button that says buy a home, just fill out the, you know, sign up for the account. You'll be ready to go. It'll take just a minute or two to finish it up. You never know. You might see that perfect house on the way home from work today. You'll be glad you did. rocketmortgage.com/security. Now. All right, Steve, on we go.
So,
Pwn to Own. I'm going to get my sportscaster voice ready here.
Yeah, we've got it. The way they wrote up the blow by blow, I just thought you'd have our listeners would get a kick out of you running through.
I don't know if I
have
a sportscaster. I'll think they, of it.
You've got a million voices, Leo.
I'll find one.
Bottom line is that China was sorely missed. China's hackers routinely win at Pwn to Own, typically sweeping the board. And notably, we talked in the previous years, the Tencent and the Keen, K-E-E-N teams that have been the big winners in the last couple of years competition. In last year's competition at Pwn to Own, the top five winners were from China, and three of them were from the Tencent group. And as I mentioned when we were on the front side of Pwn to Own, the Chinese government has decided that they're going to keep their hackers at home. And so there were no Chinese entrants this year, and it showed. There are potentially many bugs and cash prizes to be had. Last year, which was the event's 10-year anniversary, since the first one was 2007, the zero-day initiative awarded a total of $833,000 to white hat hackers. $833,000 to white hat hackers, exposing 51 different zero-day bugs. And most of those were found by Chinese researchers. This year, by comparison, despite pulling together a purse of $2 million available dollars, this year's hackers took home only $267,000 out of that total of $2 million, despite the fact that it was a target-rich environment. Oracle's VirtualBox, VMware Workstation, Microsoft Hyper-V Client, Chrome, Safari, Edge, Firefox, Adobe Reader, Microsoft Office 365, Microsoft Outlook, Nginx, Apache Web Server, Microsoft Windows SMB, and OpenSSL. All of those were valid targets for exploitation, and despite the fact very few of them were exploited. Most of the browsers took a hit. Actually, it was browsers and, in one case, VirtualBox. And $267,000 in total this year, despite the fact that the largest prize was $250,000 for a sandbox escape from hypervisor to the kernel under Hyper-V.
Now they had one of those last year.
No takers.
Isn't it possible, though, that this software was more secure, like these things have been patched? Or you think the Chinese team just has all these exploits and no one else does?
I think that they're good.
I think this is bad because now we don't know what they can do.
Oh, it's definitely bad, Leo. It's bad.
I mean, they're not exactly friendly adversaries.
No. And also, the timing was a little unfortunate because several non-Chinese competitors dropped out at the last minute after the immediately previous day's Patch Tuesday, which closed some holes they'd been planning to exploit.
Man.
So it was like, whoops.
So yeah. I have some misgivings about this whole thing because people hold on to exploits for a whole year.
Yes.
Instead
for the competition.
Responsible disclosure.
Yes.
They're trying
yes.
to make money. Now, it says here that the Pwn, the CanSec West people buy these exploits. What does that mean?
And it's weird, too. And that's the language that they use is that they.
Does that mean they hold on to them?
Yes. Well, no. It means that they purchased them. The zero-day initiative is run by Trend Micro. So Trend Micro protects their users immediately as a benefit of using Trend Micro's, anti-malware products. But then they responsibly disclose them to the vendors of the products.
Right away.
So they're not – yes, okay. yes, right away. So this year's winner – succeeded in two instances, and you'll be reading his name in a second. Richard, and you pronounced it correctly. Won the contest with 12 points for hacking Edge and Firefox, and took home out of that 267,000, 120 of that. But anyway, I thought our listeners would get a kick out of you sort of taking us through the competition.
This is a lot. I'm only going to do a few paragraphs. I'll let you do the rest.
Day one, the first day of Pwn to Own 2018 has come to a close, and so far we've awarded $162,000 U.S. dollars and 16 points toward Master of Pwn. Oh, I love this. Today saw two successful attempts, one partial success, and one failure. In total, we purchased 3 Apple bugs, 2 Oracle bugs, 3 Microsoft bugs, and a partridge in a pear tree. No, I added that. I love this. This play-by-play is pretty funny.
Yes.
The day began with Richard Ju, Fluorescence, targeting Apple Safari with a sandbox escape. Unfortunately, he couldn't get his exploit chain working within the time allotted due to a failure in the heap spray technique. Oh, no! Despite this, the bugs he brought to the contest were certainly interesting and were purchased through the regular ZDI program. I guess that's what we were talking about. They give money even though he didn't do it right, or it didn't work.
Correct.
Undaunted, Richard later returned to target Microsoft Edge with a Windows kernel elevation of privilege exploit, EOP, bringing a flair for the dramatic. After his first attempt failed, he proceeded to debug his exploit in front of the crowd while still on the clock. His second attempt nearly succeeded, but the target blue screened just as his shell started. Oh, Richard! But his third attempt succeeded with 1 minute and 37 seconds left on the clock. How long do they give him?
10 minutes.
10 minutes?
Yeah.
Whoa.
In the end, he used two use-after-free bugs in the browser linked to an integer overflow in the kernel to successfully run his code with elevated privileges. Nice going, Richard. His dramatic last-ditch... That's you, right? You wrote that.
Okay. I did.
His dramatic last-ditch effort earned him $70,000 and 7 points toward Master of Pwn.
All right, that's quite enough of that. Quite enough of that. But that is, it is dramatic. Have you ever watched one of these?
No,
it's kind of fun.
Yes,
I take it they have an audience.
Yep, they have a bunch of people watching, so it's done in front of a group. Actually, I misspoke. It's 10 minutes average, so it's three attempts and 30 minutes.
Oh, half an hour. I mean, you know.
Yeah.
That's not a lot of time.
And so
I love him debugging it on the fly.
Yes. Wow. You know, so like, you know, the clock is ticking and he's like, oh, crap, you know, why didn't that work? And so these guys know their stuff.
That's pretty good. Pretty good.
Yeah. So anyway, essentially, there were several Apple Safari escapes. All of them were elevation of privilege exploits. There was also one found in Edge that we just talked about, and one in Firefox.
All right, I'll read you the next one because it's too good. I'm sorry, I'm just looking at it.
It really is, Leo.
Up next, Nicholas Baumstark, or NixLab, from the Fenhex team targeted the Oracle VirtualBox. Apparently not one for added intrigue. His exploit immediately popped not one, not two, but three different calculator apps to rub his success into Oracle's face. His demonstration qualified as a partial success as he used an out-of-bounds read and a time of check, time of use, to still earn him $27,000 and 3 Master of Pwn points. It was a great demonstration, and we look forward to more of Niklas's research in the future. What is he, 12? Probably, right? This kid's going somewhere, folks. The final attempt on day one saw Samuel Gross, or Phalo, of Fenhex targeting Apple Safari with a Mac OS kernel elevation of privilege. Last year, his exploit involved a touch bar component, and this year proved to be no different, folks. Sam deftly leveraged a combination of a just-in-time optimization bug in the browser, whoops, Apple, and then a macOS logic bug to escape the sandbox, and finally, a kernel overwrite to execute code with a kernel extension and successfully exploit Apple Safari. This lovely exploit chain earned him $65,000 and 6 points toward Master of Pwn. As he did last year, he left a message for us on the touch bar once he was complete. What was the message? They don't say.
No.
Something like, F you, Apple, right? Take that. Holy cow. He leveraged the touch bar.
Yes.
Unbelievable.
Yes.
Unbelievable.
Yes.
If you're one of these big companies, you got to look at this day and go, oh boy. Is there video? Yep. Leaks? Wait a minute. Let me see. There seems like there might be video.
Yeah, there are videos of this happening.
Doing this.
Yeah. On the second day, it says the day began with the return of Richard, this time taking aim at Mozilla Firefox with a browser kernel elevation of privilege. He eschewed all drama today and successfully popped Mozilla Firefox on his first attempt. With his clever use of an out-of-bounds write in the browser followed by an integer overflow in the Windows kernel to earn himself another $50,000 and 5 more Master of Pwn points.
I want
to
go
to bring
next year. I
his
wanna
event
see
total
this.
To, yeah.
Look, and he gets like a drone trophy. No, that's a bug.
And he's
that's
very
funny.
Happy.
Oh, that is so funny.
Yeah.
Good for Richard Jew. Yeah. Well, you know what? I'll extend this offer to CanSec West. If they want me to do play-by-play next year, I'm available.
Well, that was great. So the follow-up news is, and I don't know what this means, DEF CON China is May 11, 12, and 13 coming up. And so it's going to be held in Beijing, and I don't know what this means in terms of the Chinese government policy relative to having a security show of that sort. Maybe if it's within China's borders, they'll allow their attackers, their hackers to attend. Because, it's a standard looking DEF CON layout and format
well,
and
I think
and
that's
presentation.
The issue. No hackers want to come to the U.S. anymore. You could get arrested.
I know.
Isn't it ironic that people will go to China? It's safer.
Yep.
Here's the message, by the way. This is a picture of the touch bar. It says, Pwned by Salo, in a happy face.
Nice.
Yeah, that's cool. And all the codes above it. No fake code there.
So, my friend, that's our podcast.
Our time is up for this fabulous episode of Security Now. Thank you, Steve Gibson.
We do this show every Tuesday around about 1:30 p.m. Pacific, 4:30 Eastern, 20:30 UTC. If you want to watch live, you can. You can also at twit.tv/live, by the way. And if you're going to do that, you might as well get in that chat room there where there's some fabulous people chatting along and providing us with images and all of that stuff. IRC.twit.tv. Now, Steve has the on-demand audio of this show, and he has something unique at grc.com. Transcripts. Elaine Ferris will be listening to this and trying to write it down. And then handmade transcripts are great, though, for searching. So if you hear something or you want to go back through one of the previous episodes, do you have transcripts for every episode?
Every single one.
Wow,
I had her.
Steve.
She didn't start at the beginning, but after a while, it was proving so useful.
Wow.
But I said, okay, let's go back and start from number one.
So you could search for honey monkeys. It would take you right to number one.
God help you.
Yeah, I don't think we've mentioned them since. we have audio and video, oddly enough, of the show. You can get that at twit.tv/sn. While you're at Gibson Research Corporation, Steve's site, grc.com, don't forget to pick up SpinRite, right? The world's best hard drive recovery and maintenance utility. And check out all the other stuff going on over there. It's a beehive of activity. Steve wraps up Squirrel, gets back to SpinRite 6 and all sorts of other fun projects. Inspector is still there. Actually, you probably do want to get Inspector these days, right? And see what CPU ID you have.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. In order to see whether you've got new microcode available.
Yeah. That's grc.com/inspector, spelled R-E. Or, you know, if you Google I-N-S-P-E-C-T-R-E, you'll find it right away. It's number one.
Yep. Bang.
What else? I guess that's about it, except thank you, Steve. And we'll be back next week. I hope you will, too, for another gripping edition of Security Now. Bye-bye.
Thank you, Leo.
Security.